Welcome to episode 14 of Pandemic Preparedness here at biodefense.com. I'm your host, Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. So much is unfolding, even as I'm recording all of this, that it's just absolutely astonishing. This chapter here is going to focus on the likely outcome of being ordered into isolation. And what's fascinating and also frightening about this outbreak is how everything that we're seeing in Liberia and Sierra Leone is really a roadmap for what's coming in the United States or Spain, even, or Europe or other countries where this outbreak is very likely to end up. Now, since I recorded the last chapter, the Washington Post did a really fascinating story called The Ominous Math of the Ebola Epidemic. And in this story, they talk about how every one infection is leading to an additional 1.5 to 2.0 new infections. So this is doubling, the number of infections are doubling about every 3 to 4 weeks. It doesn't take long for that to explode completely beyond any ability of any world government or medical system to keep up with it. And in fact, the Washington Post talks about how desperately we need to have people in hospitals and treatment centers, and yet there simply aren't enough beds. For example, they say that to halt the transmission of the disease, you need to have about 70% of infected people in treatment centers. And right now, there's only about 18% of infected people in treatment centers. And then a month from now, they estimate that we're going to need 45,000 to 50,000 people in treatment centers. And in 2 months, that's going to be 100,000 people. And in 3 months, that's going to be 200,000 people, and so on. And now, how many beds are there in Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea? Just a few hundred, really, and many of the doctors and nurses and medical staff have fled. This is also happening in Spain, where the nurses and doctors are now resigning en masse because they do not want to treat possible Ebola patients who came into close contact with that nurse who died there from Ebola after acquiring it from a missionary. So what we're seeing is the collapse of the medical system at the same time that mathematically we need to be seeing really we need a medical system that is 100 times larger than it is today in terms of number of people, staffers, number of treatment beds and centers. And it's just not happening. It's just not happening. So mathematically, it is almost impossible to see how this can be contained without some kind of intervention that really turns the tide on this thing. And the real concern right now is that this is going to become a global endemic disease that burns through populations everywhere, continuing without end, kind of like AIDS, but with a far, far higher fatality rate. AIDS is child's play compared to Ebola. So mathematically, even the experts can't see a scenario where this gets controlled in any kind of easy solution or quick solution. There is no circumstance that is on the drawing board, so to speak, that could solve this problem. In fact, the Washington Post quotes the president of Sierra Leone saying the country desperately needs 750 doctors, 3,000 nurses, 1,500 hygienists, counselors, and nutritionists. And those people aren't coming. They just aren't coming. And the number of infections is doubling every 30 days, roughly. So it is very difficult to see any kind of a scenario in which this is controlled or brought under control, or transmission is halted. And I recently wrote a story warning about the effects of that. Ultimately, you've got to realize that this is going to get into South America. And if it gets into South America, I very much doubt that the governments of many of those nations in South America can keep a lid on this outbreak. So you're likely to have an exploding outbreak throughout South, perhaps Central America, and that could lead to a massive influx of infected patients heading north into the border of the United States, thereby infecting people in America and eventually Canada as well. So it's very difficult to see how this could possibly be controlled. Now, in Liberia, the situation has become so bad that the state is turning to some rather desperate measures to attempt to bring this under control. And right now, Liberian lawmakers are debating whether to grant the president of Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, extraordinary police state powers that would give her the ability to ban all public gatherings for any reason whatsoever. I'm going to read you this article, a few paragraphs from it out of Newsday. It would allow the president to limit the right to assembly for any reason. That's a quote. And right now, the government is in a 3-month state of emergency that began really 2 months ago, so it's continuing another month. These new proposals drew heavy protests. A headline in the newspaper in Liberia said, called it, quote, tyrannical times or Ebola preventive measures. And one lawmaker said, quote, I see a kind of police state creeping in. And that is precisely it. Another person said this is tantamount to dictatorship. The police brutalize people who are from the student community. There's a lot of concern about the police powers in all of this. Now, the reason this is important is because this is exactly what's going to happen in the United States if this outbreak continues. You're going to have the suspension of all civil rights, and you're going to have the declaration of medical martial law, a medical police state. And there's already talk out there of people being issued vaccine ID cards and having to consent to mandatory Ebola vaccines and to be able to show that card at checkpoints, which could be established, or to be able to travel, to be able to cash a check, to be able to essentially do anything in public whatsoever, maybe even to vote. So they will strip you of all rights unless you have this vaccine ID card. Now, there's no proof that that is the case yet. That's conjecture, but there's talk of that happening, and it seems like it's a logical extrapolation of the direction in which this is going. You've got governments turning to more and more desperate measures, more police state measures to control the population in order to try to stop the transmission of Ebola. So there's no telling what could be invoked in Europe, in Canada, in the United States, or South America, or other nations if this continues to spread far outside of Africa. So be ready for it. Now, the real focus of this episode, this chapter, is about the coming mandatory isolation orders. If Ebola begins to really spread in the United States or whatever country that you are in, it is very likely that at some point the population will be ordered into self-isolation, which means that you'll be ordered to stay home, to not come out at all. You can't go to the grocery store. You can't gather in groups. You can't go to work. You can't go into a city bus or a subway or any form of public transportation. You can't gather for any reason whatsoever. Everyone would be ordered to stay home and isolate themselves for some period of time while the government attempts to break the chain of transmission, which might be completely impossible to do. But they're likely to try this anyway. Now, if you're ordered into this state of isolation, a couple of questions should come to mind. Number one, do you have the supplies to be able to survive a mandatory isolation order? In other words, do you have food, water, medicine, power, communications, heating or cooling, or alternatives to that? Do you have the ability to protect your family, your household? Do you have the ability to care for yourself, your pets, your family members, whatever is needed? And then the second question immediately after that is, how long? How long could this last? In Liberia, there was already a 3-day mandatory isolation ordered. But that was just the first. There could be much, much longer durations ordered based on how desperate the government has become over the outbreak. It's not difficult to imagine people being ordered into isolation for a period of weeks, in a really bad outbreak scenario, or perhaps this would be regionally ordered. So if there's an outbreak in your particular city, and let's, for this example, let's pick San Diego, just because we pick random cities for examples here. But let's say San Diego is under quarantine. It could be that people who live in San Diego would be ordered to stay in their homes for a rather uncomfortably long period of time. It could be an extended self-isolation order, or what they might call shelter in place. Now, most households are not able to support themselves for any extended period of time, certainly not for a period of many, many weeks. So it makes you wonder if this could even fly at all. But I was asked the question just yesterday. Someone was asking me about, well, who are the FEMA camps for, you know, and all these quarantine camps? And, you know, there's a lot of talk about FEMA camps out there, and even talk about FEMA coffins and cremation ovens and things like that. But in my view, in my assessment of the situation, FEMA is not going to be coming after you if you're in your own home and you're isolated in your own home. They probably are going to have their hands full just with people who are running around the streets. So you're more likely to get arrested or detained or quarantined if you're on the street or you're involved in a looting mission of, I don't know, a Walmart or something. Say you and your buddies go out at night and you try to loot the local Walmart. You might be surprised to find half the cops in there doing it first. But nevertheless, or maybe it's already been looted. There's nothing left. But if you are caught out in the open, that's when you're likely to be arrested, detained, quarantined. If you just stay home, I don't think that there's an extremely high risk. I don't think FEMA can go door to door and grab everybody out of their homes and take them away somewhere, because they just don't have the facilities to do that. They physically don't have the space, nor, I think, the manpower to do that. Now, I've heard some people say, well, they could use football stadiums and they could use large facilities that are available out there, and they could relocate a lot of people. Well, they could for some limited number, but they could not house millions of people like you have in cities like San Diego or Los Angeles or New York City and so on. So I wouldn't be overly concerned about being, you know, taken out of your home and, quote, rounded up and taken to a FEMA camp. If you can stay home and stay in isolation and take care of yourself and your family, you're probably going to avoid most of the efforts of the authorities who are out there really mostly trying to keep the peace and trying to detain people who look like they're infectious. So again, the number one targets are going to be people running around the streets, mostly at night probably, or people who become symptomatic in public. So if you're at the local bank and you start vomiting up blood, then obviously someone's going to call the authorities, and you're probably going to be quarantined in a non level 4 biohazard facility. In other words, a facility that's not equipped for level 4 biohazards, which Ebola is. And you could very quickly find yourself in quarantine with a bunch of people who are possibly even sicker than you are. And that's not a good scenario. So this is why, again, it's very, very important to be able to stay home, to be able to ride out any kind of an isolation order, and stay healthy by making sure that you don't catch Ebola. Overall, you know, it's very clear that isolation is the answer to stopping Ebola. Now, perhaps maybe there'll be a miracle drug or a miracle vaccine or something that does actually work instead of like flu vaccines, which don't. So maybe there'll be some medical miracle that comes along, but I wouldn't bet my life on that. Societies are going to need to practice a lot of isolation. And then, of course, those individuals who want to boost their immune function with natural remedies or natural immune supporting substances, they're the ones who are going to be most likely to survive. But isolation, you're going to see that across the board. Now, I want to address a couple of myths here real quick that are circulating about Ebola. One of the myths is that Ebola isn't that hard to catch, and it's no big deal. We shouldn't be worried about it. We've got the best hospitals in the world. So let's address some of these. Number one, if it was difficult to catch, then it wouldn't be doubling every 3 to 4 weeks, obviously. Apparently, it's very easy to spread from one person to another, which is, of course, why it's spreading. So to say that, well, it's hard to catch, it's not very transmissible, all these claims that we hear out there are nonsense. Otherwise, it would never have reached the point where it already has reached today. Secondly, people say, well, we have the best hospitals in the world. Well, so does Spain. And a nurse caught Ebola in Madrid while treating another patient who was infected, and she had access to medical gear, and she had access to the best hospitals in the world. The hospitals in Madrid are just as good, or if not better, than hospitals anywhere in the United States. So, they had first-world technology. Spain is an advanced country, and still she caught it. So just having first-world hospitals isn't enough. And the truth is that the Ebola virus doesn't care how expensive your medical bills are. The Ebola virus will spread regardless of your economic status. It does not discriminate against people based on income, skin color, religion, sexual orientation, or anything else. Ebola just spreads because it can. Literally, that's why it spreads, because it can. So all these ideas that, well, we have the best hospitals in the world, or it's hard to catch, and so on, are nonsense. These people that walked in and out of Thomas Duncan's apartment in Dallas while wearing no protective gear, truly insane. Because everybody who's a virologist who has worked around level 2, level 3, or level 4 biohazards, and Ebola is level 4, which is the highest level. There is no level 5. But anybody who's worked around these knows that you should be terrified of a level 4 biohazard unless you're wearing very heavy-duty protective gear. These people that deal with these at the U.S. Army Research Center, Fort Detrick, for example, they wear 3 layers of protective gloves, positive pressure suits. They have years of training. They are very, very careful. They don't even use scalpels, for example, in when they're researching monkeys and drawing blood and so on. They don't use scalpels because the risk of being cut and then killed is so high. All you need is one drop of blood on a cut or a nick or a needle prick, and you can contract Ebola that easily. So anyone who did walk in and out of Duncan's apartment who does not have Ebola should consider themselves extremely lucky. They dodged a bullet, and that bullet could have very easily cost them their lives. Now, there is going to be an effort, actually it's already underway, to really downplay the severity of the outbreak. This has been true throughout history, except with the swine flu situation, which was completely fabricated and hyped up and exaggerated to sell vaccines. But when it comes to things that are really deadly, like Ebola, the government tends to go out of its way to downplay the situation in order to calm fears and prevent people from going into panic. For example, in U.S. history, there was an outbreak of Ebola in the Reston facility, where they had over 400 research monkeys. And when this outbreak took place, there were a couple of people who were believed to be infected, and Ebola might have been in the wild. There was fear that it had spread to their spouses, that it could be on the streets. And so talking to the press, there was a concerted effort to downplay the severity of the problem, to describe it as not that dangerous, to say, oh, this is just routine. And when the news cameras saw somebody walking out of there in a big biohazard spacesuit looking thing, they would just say, oh, this is just extra precaution, or what they say now, an abundance of caution. Nothing to be worried about. Well, whenever you hear the government say there's nothing to be worried about, that's usually a clue that there is something to be worried about. So it's like the government very rarely tells it like it is. It seems like they either exaggerate the problem for a political or financial purpose, as happened with the swine flu, or they downplay the problem, as seems to be happening today with Ebola, in order to try to prevent panic. Which, I suppose, from one perspective, that could make sense. Maybe they figure the public is so uninformed and so unprepared that if people really knew the truth, that they would freak out and panic, and then that would cause a much bigger problem than what we already have. So I suppose that's an argument that they are making. But I tend to think that we should be better informed so that we can have less panic because we're better prepared. I think that knowledge, information, and preparedness creates calm, and that it is the lack of knowledge and the lack of truth-telling that makes people fearful because they don't know what to believe. They know they can't trust the official explanations. So I think it's the denial of reality that makes people more afraid because they don't know what to trust or what's really happening. Not knowing, you know, just fear of the unknown can be quite intense. It's better for people to know the truth and to be able to then prepare for it. This is especially true given the topic of this chapter, which is the isolation mandates that are likely to happen anywhere that this outbreak really spreads. And in these scenarios of isolation or so-called shelter in place, you create, as a government, you create panic by not having encouraged people to prepare in advance. So if there is a shelter in place type of order that comes down, a national emergency, let's say, or a local, maybe a state emergency or a citywide emergency, then people are going to find themselves unprepared, not having enough food for starters, and then that alone will tend to cause panic. And that alone will tend to cause people to be out in the streets, perhaps looting, perhaps protesting, perhaps even marching. You know, I can see public protests taking place. And these are precisely the kinds of crowds that the government does not want to see and will very likely crack down on with a lot of force. They will, as is being discussed in Liberia right now, they can outlaw all public gatherings. So your right to freely assemble, which is protected under the Bill of Rights, will be completely nullified and squashed by the declaration of a national emergency. So you won't have these rights anymore. And that is the kind of activity which is, again, likely to get you rounded up and thrown into a quarantine camp somewhere, i.e. a FEMA camp. And that's not where you want to end up. In fact, I remember there was an episode of Doomsday Preppers, which is really worth reviewing right now because quite a few people on that show were preparing against a pandemic outbreak, and now it's here. You know, so they were very much ahead of the curve on that. But one family had built a giant underground pod under their garage, and there was a large metal hatch in their garage where they could open the hatch, and the whole family could climb down in this giant pod. I mean, it was huge. Very large. It went down like 16 feet below their garage. And then they could close the hatch and they could live in there for some period of time. They had extra air or a way to hand crank an air baffle to get more air in. And the thought occurred to me, because they lived in a regular neighborhood, the outside view of their house was just like a regular suburbia type of environment. But it occurred to me that if there was ever a sweep-through type of action, where, let's say, theoretically, DHS came through or medical authorities came through the neighborhood and tried to take everybody out of their homes. They would go door to door looking for people and taking them away, right? Now, I've already mentioned that I don't think that is going to happen, but this is just a theoretical. In that scenario, if it were to ever happen to you, it seems like one of the best strategies would be to do what this family had prepared for, which would be to go down in your own underground bunker and conceal the entrance to that so that even if somebody came into your home and was searching around your home looking for you or your family members or whatever, you know, they're going to be in and out of there. They're not going to stick around and monitor your home hour after hour, day after day. If you go underground for a day or two and the sweep is done, then you could reemerge from your underground garage pod and you could be back in your home. Of course, you'd want to do it in a stealthy kind of way. You wouldn't want to advertiser there, but you could avoid the roundup if it ever happened. And you know, this is true for lots of scenarios. People might live in different countries around the world where there's civil war, and being able to go down and escape into an underground bunker in your own home and then reemerge after the sweep is done, that might actually save your life, because maybe there's some very destructive enemy force that's sweeping through your town and just literally pulling everybody out of their homes and killing them. I mean, this has happened before. Look at the history of civil war in Bosnia, for example, or heck, any civil war, the civil war of the United States. So this kind of thing has happened in history, and being able to really sort of disappear yourself underneath your own home for some period of time and then reemerge could actually be a very valuable strategy. Now, I'm not saying you should dig up your garage floor and install a giant concrete pod. That might take a lot of work. It may not be worth that. There are probably far easier ways to do this. The other problem with that pod was that it had a giant hatch, which was clearly visible on the floor of the basement. So anybody really coming through there would say, hey, what's this giant hatch on the floor of the basement? Let's open it. And, you know, if they opened it, they would find you. Or if they couldn't open it, they might really want to open it, thinking, well, gosh, this is locked. There must be a bunch of gold down in here or something. And then they would really try to open it. So if you do have a pod or an underground bunker or something, you want to be able to get in there and then to not advertise the fact that you're in there. And maybe you need to stay in there a few hours or even a few days before reemerging. And at that time, you might reemerge into a ghost town. You might be the only ones left. No one else is there. So obviously, you'd want to practice light discipline at night. You don't want to turn on your lights. You don't want to, you know, create smoke by burning things. You don't want to create any signals that sort of advertise the fact that you are still there when the authorities think that area has been cleaned out, at least under this theoretical scenario. But again, I have to emphasize, I really can't see FEMA having the resources, or even DHS, going door to door pulling people out of their homes. It seems like they would want people to stay in their homes. I can see them going through the streets and picking up people who are wandering around under martial law, for example. I can see them picking up looters. I can see them cracking down on protests. All those kinds of things are very viable under an outbreak scenario, but it's difficult to imagine them going door to door taking people. Now, could they go door to door demanding everybody be vaccinated? Yes, that is potentially very likely. I could definitely see that. And they will probably use census data to determine how many people are at your location, which means, therefore, how many vaccine shots they should give. And this sort of brings up one more reason why I think some people are rightly concerned about their privacy when they're giving answers to census data or census questions. You know, if you said there are five people in your household, then and if there's a vaccine mandate, they're going to show up and say, well, all five of you line up to get your vaccine, because now it's the law, you can't say no. And if you only have four lined up and one person's hiding in the basement or something, then that's going to be suspicious, because you told them on the census data that you had five. So you see how that could create a lot of friction. And this may be one way that they try to enforce a vaccine mandate. Now, by the way, a quick note on the vaccine itself. As of right now, which is mid-October 2014, the vaccine for Ebola is in human trials. But they're not testing the Ebola vaccine against Ebola. What they're doing is they're testing it for safety or side effects in the clinical trial group. They're not taking that group of volunteers and then exposing them all to Ebola. All right, that's not part of the plan. So when you hear that the vaccine is being tested, it's being tested to see if it makes people sick, or if it causes, you know, paralysis or side effects or vomiting or whatever. That's all it's being tested for. It is not being tested against Ebola itself. So when this vaccine is approved by the FDA, which is a given, they're going to approve it as an experimental vaccine that has to be approved under emergency provisions, whatever, when they approve it, there will be no scientific data showing that the vaccine worked to stop Ebola. That is not part of the clinical trial. That's not part of the testing. So you're going to probably see a lot of aggressive pushing of this vaccine to say, well, everybody needs to be vaccinated. It's been proven safe by the FDA. Well, okay, maybe it's been proven safe, but has it been proven effective? Does it stop Ebola? Or how effective is it exactly? Does it reduce your risk of dying from Ebola by 1% or 90%? You know, because flu vaccines are not very effective. All the data out there show that the flu vaccines prevent flu at best in about one half to one person out of 100. So about 99 people out of 100 who take the flu shot derive no benefit from it. Now, those numbers may be very different in an Ebola outbreak with a very high fatality rate. Let's say the fatality rate of Ebola is 50%. Let's say it's actually higher at the moment, but let's just suppose it's 50%. The fatality rate of the flu is really far less than 1%. So perhaps if there's a vaccine that does work, then it could reduce fatalities substantially from Ebola, again, if it works. But they won't know that by the time it is approved. So if you agree to take this shot, and you may have no choice because they may line you up essentially under threat of arrest and say you're going to take the shot regardless. So if you take the shot, you may have no benefit. It may be a neutral effect, for example, no benefit and no downside. It could be a negative effect, that there's some side effect that they covered up because they have total legal immunity, especially with vaccines in a national emergency. So you could have a devastating side effect that could actually potentially kill you or put you into a coma, or maybe it does nothing. And then the third outcome is that maybe it's a positive effect. It could actually reduce your risk of either contracting Ebola or replicating Ebola inside your body if you do contract it, so thereby reducing your risk of dying from it and possibly transmitting it to others. So you've got this huge spectrum of effects to really watch for, everything from neutral to extremely negative to potentially even extremely positive. We just don't know. There's no evidence either way at the moment, and there won't be any such evidence on the day that it is released and approved by the FDA. That's the whole point here, is we still won't know if it works on the day that it's released. And it is not at all likely that the government is going to accept no as an answer or honor vaccine exemptions in a big outbreak emergency. This is going to be a very contentious issue because there are so many people who don't want the vaccine and who believe they have the right to say no to vaccines. With a very high fatality rate, Ebola circulating in the wild in your local area, the government is probably not going to honor any kind of vaccine exemptions. They're just going to force everybody to be injected. Now, maybe the vaccine itself, the Ebola protein part of the vaccine, might indeed be harmless. But the question is, what else are they going to put in the vaccine? Will they put adjuvants in it? Will they have mercury in it as a preservative? Will they have aluminum in it? Will they have oil extracts in it, which they've used in some vaccines as an adjuvant? What else are they going to put in that vaccine? That is the question. Or will there be things that in the vaccine that they didn't intend to have in it? For example, the polio vaccine was injected in about 98 million Americans, even while it contained a hidden cancer virus called SV40. It was actually a simian virus from monkeys. This virus was injected into almost 100 million Americans, and this is a true history that the CDC doesn't like to openly admit, but in fact they scrubbed it from their website, I think, in 2013. But it is true that happened. So that was caused by a mistake, an oversight, because vaccine manufacturing isn't a perfect science. There can be mistakes anywhere along the way. So what if there's another mistake and there's some other virus that gets into the batch that they didn't intend to have in there, but it gets in there anyway because of a quality control problem, And then all of a sudden, everybody is forcibly being injected with this other virus that might cause cancer 5 years down the road, or rabies 5 years down the road, or who knows what. It could be almost anything. So this is a reason why a lot of people are very skeptical about vaccines, and they want to be able to maintain the right to say no, even in a massive pandemic. But the real rule of thumb here is, if they don't find you, they can't vaccinate you. So if you're underground in your bunker, in your pod under your garage, or if you're out in the country somewhere in some very remote area, and they're probably not going to be sweeping through that area, or they literally can't find you, they physically can't find you because you're in your log cabin somewhere way out in the wilderness, then obviously you're not going to be forcibly vaccinated. And whether that's good or bad has yet to be told. That chapter of history has not yet been written. But rule of thumb is, if they can't find you, they probably can't jab you with a needle. So the bottom line here, to wrap all this up, is, number one, prepare for isolation. That is a mandatory isolation where you're going to need to lock yourself down in your own home, shelter in place. This would follow a declaration of a local emergency or a national emergency. I don't think the risk of door-to-door taking people away is a very high risk. But I do see a very high possibility of door-to-door vaccine mandates with a vaccine that is not proven to even work. So that's something to watch out for. Make sure you have enough supplies to survive in your own home for an extended period of time. This includes heating and cooling, depending on what you need in your area. But, of course, food, water, medicine, basic personal hygiene, communication, batteries for emergency lighting, and things like that. Also, of course, self-defense for your home to ward off the looters that are likely to be running around. And again, the people most likely to be taken into quarantine are going to be the people who are on the streets, who ignore the orders to not be on the street. You know, martial law. This is medical martial law now. This is a police state scenario. And people who are out and about, especially at night, are likely to get picked up and thrown into quarantine centers, which is really kind of a death camp scenario. So you want to stay away from that. Stay home. Try not to cause trouble. Have enough supplies. Share supplies with some of your neighbors if you can. You know, try to help out. But stay out of trouble. Stay out of the clutches of the police state. And that is the best strategy for getting through this, making it to the other side when this is all over. Because it will be all over. Even if it sweeps through the population, there will be a point where the population is either dead or immune. And the survivors will have immunity, and they'll go on to, you know, rebuild society. So my goal is to help you get to that point, be one of the survivors, get through this, rebuild society, and help create a better society where perhaps we don't have the risks of these types of things happening again in the future. Because if you look at what's causing this, you know, it's ecological devastation. It's possibly military organizations conducting too many unsafe bioengineering experiments on bioweapons, for example. That could be part of the cause. Maybe this is due to the fact that most people in our modern world are immunosuppressed. Too many people are on medications. Too many people don't have nutrients to keep their immune systems functioning. There could be all kinds of reasons that we as a society can address after the Ebola burnout, if that's what happens, which, again, we hope and pray that that doesn't happen. I don't want to... It would not be fun, even to be a survivor. It would not be a pleasant experience to be living through a massive Ebola outbreak. It's not something to look forward to. It would be devastating on many, many levels, and it would be a very dark time for humanity if that happened. But such dark times, even when they do occur, they don't last forever. So there will be a bright side on the other side of this, even if it does take place. So thanks for listening. I hope you find this useful and informative. More episodes are coming here on biodefense.com. Feel free to share this audio file on the torrent websites and anywhere else where you might be able to get the word out. My name is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. You can check out my work at naturalnews.com.